If this was a class that was supposed to talk about how arguments were made, Conceptual Foundations is the class that tries to explain how all moral... Obviously, we cannot listen and pass, and I respect that. I respect people who don't want to multitask, because they say it's really not that good for us. I'll just repeat that sentence again, because I know where I was. If this was the class that was supposed to teach you how arguments were made, Conceptual Foundations is the class that says that all moral arguments are made from one of two vantage points, one of two perspectives, either consequentialist framework of the way the world works, or a deontological framework for how the moral world works. When you understand those two frameworks, you can locate yourself and other people's arguments in those frameworks, and you are better able to defend and refute your position and the opponent's. Mm-hmm.
Do we talk about roles as well?
Didn't you ask me that?
Exactly.
And I gave the same answer that I'm going to give. Yes.
Yes,
okay. Or there's someone else in the class who's asked me that exact same question. I think it might have been you. Yes. So the way that the class is structured is that we look at the two grand frameworks, and we look at them first from the day-to-day morality, which is where most of healthcare bioethics, medical ethics, comes in. Patient, doctor, should I have an abortion or should I not? That kind of thing, about our day-to-day morality. And then there's aggregate morality, morality about the political, the way the political ought to be organized, the way that we distribute resources. That's what, for example, Zeke Emanuel and Scott Halpern in our department look at, macro kind of issues in the aggregate. And we look at what happens in the two grand frameworks, consequentialism and deontology, when you kick it up to the level of the aggregate. And that's where we talk about roles and we talk about consequentialism. What does that look like at the aggregate when we're thinking about resource allocation? And then about a third of the class, or maybe a fourth of the class, is looking at the moral theories of bioethics and how they intersect with the two grand frameworks. And while it sounds like a philosophy class, it actually arms you with the tools to be able to assess bioethical arguments writ large. So that is what that class is about. It has the same structure as this one, not a paper to take home assignments of a sort, rather than a paper. But any questions on that? Any questions about the turning the outline into a paper? Let me review the procedure. If you've got it good to go, I need that paper back. I don't have to physically have it. I could have a snapshot of it, but I need to know that it was an outline that said good to go, and then you could just hand me the prose paper. If you revised it with track changes, I want the original. Again, I can have just a picture of it, and I need an electronic copy of the track change version, and I need the prose. So I need three things from you. If you did not have an original, good to go. If you had a needs tweaking, little tweaking, oh my God, you should see me, whatever category that was not good to go, I need three things. If you got a good to go, I need two. Again, you don't have to physically give me the paper if you want to do the whole, contemporary electronic thing. And that's not due until December 21st. Grades aren't actually due to the system, oddly, until January 2nd, even if you're graduating. Figure that one out. If you graduate in December, we'll take your grades in January. Okay. But that is the truth. So, all right. Wrapping it up for our few week break, for those of you returning, we are going to look at informed consent. This was the week that we were reading Beecham and Childress, their classic, an excerpt from their classic book, Principles of Biomedical Ethics, that they wrote in the late 70s and keep revising it, and other editions coming out. They don't change what you've read. They only change the pieces around what you've read and continue to make good money on it, and, God bless them for it. But we read the 2001 version. The page numbers change between versions, but the content doesn't. I still think that in terms of articulating the conceptual understanding of informed consent and showing why we really need to think about it as problematic and not as the sacred cow that we treat it as in the United States, I think Beecham and Childress are still the best bang for the buck. And I'm going to try to explain to you today, and actually you're going to help me, though we're small, we'll all have to do a lot of talking, we're going to talk through why this procedure, this process that we call informed consent, while on the surface seeming so straightforward, is actually at the end of the day mired in complexity despite everybody's best efforts to achieve it. Which doesn't mean that we should throw it out, but it does mean that we've got some problems that at least we need to recognize and maybe even try to troubleshoot. We're going to talk today about how there are five elements of informed consent: disclosure, understanding, voluntariness, confidence, and consent. We'll talk about standards for disclosure, professional, reasonable person, and subjective. And we'll talk, something missing in the outline. We'll talk about substituted judgment, the pure autonomy standard for surrogate decision making, and the best interest standard for surrogate decision making. And we'll look again, just as we will do through each of these, we'll look at the problems of any of the three of these. The final element is the actual consent. And we'll work through these five concepts by looking at a lot of examples and thinking about, from both the provider and the patient's perspective, what ought to be constitutive of these five concepts. But then we're going to turn to a very famous piece in bioethics, a classic, as you can achieve only in bioethics, in something you've written in 1987. But it is a classic nevertheless. It's a piece called Abandoning Informed Consent, which was originally published in the Hastings Center and has been reprinted now many times. But it is one of the founding fathers, Veach, who is an MD, and he's made famous now this concept that informed consent, while trying so very hard to be an egalitarian principle, a democratic principle, a leveling of the playing field process, is actually quite authoritarian. That, of course, goes against all conventional wisdom about what informed consent is all about and what we're trying to do. To understand why he's so worried about this, we will think about the conception of the good from both the medical model, the institution of medicine, and what particular patients may hold as their conception of the good. He is going to point to the conflicting interests that patients have for protecting their health, protecting other interests, and even protecting their moral agency, the kind of moral obligations that are the core of their lives. And then we're going to think about the solution he talks about or proposes. We should sort of cluster ourselves into communities of deep values. We'll talk about what would that mean if we could do it, and then we'll talk about whether we actually could do it at all. Okay, so the theme tonight is problematizing informed consent. And the first thing we want to talk about is disclosure. Disclosure and understanding are flip sides of the same coin, or the alternative part of the process. Disclosure is what comes from providers to patients, and understanding is what patients take in. Both are mired, as I said, in difficulty. So the first thing I want to do is get a list of all the things that providers or patients might want disclosed. So from either or both perspective, what ought we to convey to patients, or what as patients do we want to know? And let's get a nice little list up here. If this was a day you didn't want to participate, I'm sorry to tell you, you should have come Tuesday.
So risk, benefits.
All right, risk, benefits. And when we think about informed consent, we want to be thinking about it in this context for a procedure or treatment or something like that. We don't want to be thinking in the research context. Today we're going to stay clinical. So the risks and benefits of what?
Of the treatment to the individual.
All right, of the treatment. Okay?
The alternatives.
All right, the alternatives.
So, like, costs or health insurance
issues?
Yeah.
All right. Costs.
Side effects.
Mm-hmm.
Anticipated outcomes. Kind of how an individual will feel afterwards. How long the recovery process. Disability associated with that.
Not a good day to be in the corner. What else?
Maybe like societal concerns.
Like what?
Like so someone's gonna receive like cancer treatment, right? Just discussing like potential side in terms of like, you know, having to shave one's hair and like.
Okay, so let's use social instead of societal, because societal makes it sound like you're going to tell, we're going to talk about, well, how is society going to feel about me getting, as opposed to my social concerns. Right. Okay, good. Social concerns as opposed to physical, for example. Mm-hmm. I know that's not how you spell physical. Make it up. Okay.
The procedures of the treatment.
Okay. And procedures of the treatment, and we'll even say in detail, or in what level of detail. Like, oh yeah, they didn't tell you that there was going to be a drain when you went home. Details of that type. As well as just details of, okay, well, we're going to go in, and, okay, what else?
The physician's interest in procedures, research, background.
All right, I'm going to call that the conflict of interest. Or there are other interests in it. Good. So some could be financial, but we understand by your suggestion there that it isn't just that I've got stock in Merck or Bristol Myers Squibb, which makes Taxol. So that's why you're getting Taxol. It's not just that I've got stock. It's that I've got a research protocol right now non-endoscopic treatment of GERD, and so no on the endoscopy, or, you know, I don't believe that study in animals. I think we should have endoscopy, so I'm kind of running a protocol. So there could be lots of interest, not necessarily just financial.
Sometimes when consent is obtained for a physician to do a procedure, he's not going to actually be the one to do the procedure.
Yes. Okay. The who. Right. So I'm booking the top of the division here, and that's who's doing the informed consent. Guess what? It's resident time. Yeah. Okay?
Maybe something about the skill or the familiarity of the provider with the procedure.
Okay, the experience with it. How many times, for example?
Potential accommodations, in the sense like if someone receives a certain type of treatment, they might have to get a special bed made at home, or just things like that as well that come along with the treatment.
Yeah, how can I name that? That's very good, but what should I say here? I'll use the word accommodation, and since you explained it so nicely, and I don't know how to spell accommodation, so let's just put it right there. So what is it?
Supplies
or modifications to your behavior, to your, you know, life, or, you know, home, or, you know, something like that. Okay, good. What else?
The personal success rate of the person who has done this procedure.
Okay. Anything else?
Further complications that could arise that would require other consent.
Okay. Good. All right. That's a whole list. What percentage of consents tick off every one of these lists? Give me a percentage, you think.
None.
Yeah, right. 0 to 1%. Great. So already we can see that we've got some concerns here with informed consent, because I'm going to ask you in a second, do you think any of these are unreasonable for a patient to want? And yet if they are not unreasonable, then the fact that we actually don't do them makes us think that perhaps reasonable things that patients want to know aren't getting known. All right. Anything up there that you don't think is reasonable to ask to want to know as a patient? Is there anything up there that it's like, why do you need to know that? Anything up there? Okay. Go ahead.
Is anything going to be changed in my medical records or my regular care?
All right. Regular care. Med records. Okay, great. Adding another one. Anybody think that there's something in there that's not reasonable to ask? Going once, going twice. No. Okay, so Let's talk about which one of these things, which of these things do you think are rarely offered? And tell me, if they're rarely offered, how important would it be? Give me something up there that you think is important that as a patient, but you would think would be rarely offered to you as information.
Voluntarily, or like, if you ask it?
Oh, if you ask, that's different. But a lot of people, so I like that question. So let's think first of the standard spiel, because we are trying to, if there's something that you ask, I'm not sure, there are things actually on this list that I think would chafe if you ask. But the question we should answer first is, what will be offered versus what will not be offered? So tell me something that would not necessarily, would unlikely be offered, but it's something you'd want to know.
Conflict of interest. I don't think most people tell you as part of the consent for a procedure whether there's any conflict.
Okay, so I agree with you. Publications-wise, you need to spell all that out. But when it's a procedure that actually is about your body or your kid's body, you're not usually going to get that forthcoming. Okay, and I'm not sure that you would have a good... It's kind of one of those questions that if you ask it, it's hard to ask it and have a... answer of yes, I have stock, and not have some, you know, bad feelings going on. So it's a tough question to ask, and it's not an answer that would automatically be given.
And it's also, for most things, not pertinent. There are many things that are done as procedures for which there is no real conflict of interest.
Probably right, but let's think about some cases where it would actually matter. Can you give me some examples of where it would matter?
Well, it's orthopedic procedures. You know, oftentimes orthopods own an interest in the device companies or have some kind of...
Okay.
On their speaker boards or...
Okay. All right. It's, I love the Smith and Klein knee, you know. I know that the Jones knee is, you know. All right. What else?
Recommendation for dialysis. Specific clinics when doctors also own those dialysis clinics.
Okay, all right, so I might recommend, in fact, we didn't put up here in general MD or RN recommendations. And that's a different kind of thing. What I mean here is, as the provider, I think you should do this, is often part of the consent. But yes, let's talk about how I may steer you to this particular place and not that particular place. And maybe that's because I trust them more, which would not be a conflict, or maybe it's because there's some connection I have. Okay? What else?
I think in the case of rare diseases like Boucher's disease, we've seen different pharmaceutical companies lobby specifically to physicians to use kind of their drug, knowing that this will be, say, like an ongoing procedure where the patient will have to use that drug and slow that drug for years on through their life.
Okay, and I don't know that it isn't just orphan or rare diseases. I mean, have you ever noticed that some of the providers have samples? I mean, HUP, they're kind of down on this, but if you go to private practice, you will see samples only from one manufacturer and not another manufacturer. So what's the reason why you have samples from only one? Now, I'm not saying it's stock, but it could be that you that's the rep that you deal with. The rep is from that particular company, and that means that... If that's the place where you get a lot of your supply, it isn't necessarily that you've made the evidence-based decision that it's actually the best product. I gave a talk in Pennsylvania College of Optometry, and they talked about how this one particular school was an Allergan school. And so everybody comes out with all kinds of Allergan information, all kinds of Allergan samples. Once they graduate, they've got Allergan samples, and poor Bausch & Lomb. But it's not because they actually said, you know, we have done a lot of trials and we know Allergan's better. But patients who are constantly being told, what contact solution should I use? Allergan. Are getting a recommendation that's really based not in evidence-based, but in the kind of background and training that the person had. Okay.
Or who gives them their Eagles and Phillies tickets.
Right? And it can be even more insidious than that. Right. Penn has even forbidden the use of pens. I mean, it's gotten so concerning that these small gifts create a kind of obligation. In fact, there was a wonderful paper. It was a pen paper on pens, as a matter of fact. But it was called something like the perils of small gifts. but it's a paper that you can easily get from the American Journal of Bioethics, but it talked about how even something as small as a pen sets up in your mind this, wow, I should really, you know, do something for them. Okay, what else on here is unlikely to be disclosed automatically and something you might want?
If this costs.
Okay. Cost is probably one of the rarest of things discussed. Tell me why cost isn't disclosed in informed consent.
Physicians don't know what it
costs. First of all, because they don't know. Okay. They don't know. Number two, what else?
Well, because the cost is different for everyone.
Yes, right. So if you have an Aetna insurance and they've negotiated a rate, there is one cost for the thing, but Blue Cross and Blue Shield pays another, and out of pocket, God love you, they're going to pay another, and on it goes. So there isn't just one price. It's like airline tickets. Everybody's seat in it can be a different price. So even if you would be knowing in general, you wouldn't know particularly for that person. Okay?
Sometimes you don't know the cost going in because sometimes the cost of a procedure is based on the amount of time that one is the procedure. So
okay.
Our time is different, so a case that could take
okay.
4 hours for
all right.
somebody could be 10 hours
right.
for another, and the cost is
okay.
different.
They expect you to be in the recovery room for half an hour because most people wake up. 8 hours have gone by. You don't seem to be able to get woken up, and they're charging you by the hour. So you it was a whole lot more than they thought. You needed two Band-Aids. They're each $50 each, I mean, exactly.
Well, and the other part of it is in terms of your upfront cost, different procedures cost different things, but because many people's out-of-pocket cost is the same regardless of what the reimbursement is. So your cost as an insured individual may be capped at a certain amount, while the cost of the procedure to your insurance company
mm-hmm.
is different.
Right, exactly. Okay, great. So cost would be one of those things. What else? Now let's talk about... Go ahead.
Just going to say that success rate.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Tell me about that.
I think in general, they do talk about potential complications, but they don't talk about their rate of complications.
Okay. So I think you're probably more likely to hear it on the positive side. Yes, I know that there's a 1-200 risk of a miscarriage after amnio. I've got to tell you, I've done God knows how many. I've never seen a miscarriage. That's a statistic. That has nothing to do with me. You would hear. I've done three spinal taps. One I had to get somebody else for. The other one, we kind of had a complication. I'm on number three, but three's the charm. Not usually said. Okay? What else?
Also, I mean, in terms of success rates, most people don't track their individual success rates over time.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be easy on the leading edge to say, yes, I've done 10 procedures, and of the 10, 5 people knock wood have gone home. But I think as time goes on, it's a lot harder to track
mm-hmm.
the success rates.
So okay.
Most people quote a standard statistic because that is what can be found in the literature rather than their own, because that is a found number versus their own number.
Right. Now, the one thing they do know is how much experience they've actually had, and they at least know it in the sense of not too much or a whole lot. That they actually do know. And that may also be not something that is forthcoming. Another one that would not be always forthcoming would be the who. In fact, sometimes the who, they'll just, you might actually not get a real answer there, even when you ask for the who. That there's a who and there's a who. There's a me standing by but not actually holding the scalpel who, and then there's no, I'm actually going to hold the scalpel who, and right. Okay, what other things do you feel like you sometimes don't get enough of? Give me an example. It doesn't have to be you. In fact, it'd be better, maybe it's not you, but something that you would have liked to know about, or somebody you loved, or some friend you heard, or some case that you know of, you would have liked a piece of information, you thought it was important, and you didn't get it in the informed consent.
Well, I think the alternatives to
okay.
Because surgeons are often quick to cut, and medical
right.
doctors are often quick for medicine, and perhaps
right.
your alternatives for your, for example, if you need a new knee,
right.
you may have several different types of treatment available to you, but only be offered one or two of those.
Right. I saw this interesting study that was in Annals of all places, so or archives, but it definitely wasn't any, you know, fruitcake kind of journal. And it divided people up into three categories: the back surgery, the back medicine, and the yoga group. And the yoga group did best. So now that will be interesting to see how many times that study gets cited by either the orthopedic surgeons or the folks who are doing medical management. So it isn't just because they're hiding things that are true from you. That's not really what it's about. It's about the even an evidence-based study can always have a flawed methodology. It may not be replicable. You know how anytime there's a big study that comes out, they get commentators from other places, and they'll always say, well, it's just one study, and we don't really know what it means, but we'll be thinking that through. And, you know, doesn't mean that anybody's going to radically about face on practice. So when you come from a certain disciplinary perspective, you have done it this way over and over again, and it seems to have worked, and then that's, you know, the lens through which you view it. Not because you're trying to not disclose, but because it is the perspective you come from. So talking about alternatives is often not a, well, you could do this, you could do this, or you could do this. Good luck, and let me know what you decide. How is alternative conversation often had in informed consent processes? And here you go. A, B, C, multiple choice it, and let me know. That isn't usually how it goes. How does it go?
Well, usually what the provider prefers to do comes first, and it's more heavily weighted, and the verbiage is different, and and prejudicial.
Yes, and prejudicial in the sense that all human beings have a filter, and that filter is based on a huge set of factors, including how much judgment one has brought to bear, how much experience, bad experiences with alternatives, anecdotal, what you prioritize. For example, it could be the case that one of the alternatives would be something that would carry a higher risk, even if it would have other kinds of benefit, like fewer side effects. I'll give you an example of one that hit the newspapers a couple of years ago, stuck with me. There was a study, and many of you have seen this, that a VBAC, so vaginal birth after a cesarean, carried a 1% statistical risk of uterine rupture. And so there were hospitals, quite a few in New Jersey, I don't think that Huff is one of them, that just would refuse any kind of VBAC. They just, no more VBACs. Why? Because of a 1% risk. But now let's imagine that you're the scaredy cat that I am. And so the physician that I am, I'm very nervous about a 1% risk. I think a 1% risk of a uterine rupture, yeah, we probably will save your life, but you've got a uterine rupture, so it could be life-threatening. It could also be fertility sabotaging. And no, we're just not going to let you have that choice. On the other hand, if you very, very much value non-interventional, a less invasive birth, a more natural birth process, you might view that as a 99% chance that you will not have a uterine rupture, and those are pretty good odds. I mean, at the time, I looked up statistics of what is 1%? What are the kinds of things that carry a 1% risk? And it was interesting. There's not a lot of things that carry a 1% risk, but astronauts dying in a shuttle is a 1% risk, and yet we let them go up. I mean, you know, we let them go up all the time in space and do their thing. So, anyway, what I want to say here is that depending on my filter, scaredy cat autumn, or, hey, 99%, it's going to be okay, will shape whether your policy is not under my watch or let's give it a shot, you know? Okay, but that wouldn't change the 1% statistic. The 1% statistic is the 1% statistic, but the way that you talk about that choice will very much depend on a whole host of things, including your own psychological risk aversion. That isn't a criticism at all of the medical profession. That is simply an acknowledgement of human life. And that's one of the things that Veach is really going to register, is going to groove on. Tell me what else. Give me an example of something you may not have gotten, a piece of information, something you wanted to know from that list that you didn't get but you would have wanted to know. Or prospectively, if you make up a case. Go ahead.
You know, people have... even something simple as having a mole removed and go home with stitches. I had, you know, a mole removed and I swim. So nobody told me that I wasn't going to be able to swim for 2 weeks.
That's a perfect kind of example. Not being able to drive, not being able to swim, not being able to sex, not being able to have a bath. I love baths. The one I hate the most, no tea with cream and sugar in the morning before the blood test. I cannot tell you how many times I've put off, in fact, I universally put off any kind of cholesterol test, because I'm going to give up my tea in the morning? I don't think so. So when you find that out, you're like, no, of course I had my tea. Thanks. So any of these things that are health-wise, like in terms of will you live or die, they usually cover those. Will it affect the quality of your life as you define it, especially in the short term? I mean, if you're never going to swim again, forever and ever, they will probably mention it. But if you're not going to be able to swim for 24 hours or 48 hours or a week, they're like, get over it. Unfortunately for you, it actually matters. But like the reason I never get blood tests. And the problem with informed consent is that if it's something that matters deeply to you and it doesn't deeply matter to the person doing disclosure and you make a big fuss about it, the reaction is what?
They look at it like you're crazy.
Right, then you're the nut. Right, exactly. Because after all, it isn't colossally important. It isn't of the magnitude. In fact, when we think about the biases, when we talk about the conception of the good, and I don't, again, at all mean to say anybody escapes bias, because they don't. But if we talk about the bias of biomedicine in the U.S. today, one of the things that we would talk about is physical health as greater than all else. So the recommendation is you get a cholesterol checked every 3 years. That's what the recommendation says. You need the blood test. I don't care about your morning coffee. So, and there are many, many examples of this where for patients, it isn't always the case that the absolute maximization of physical health and the absolute minimization of risk to physical health outweighs what is in that all else. And that creates a problem for the process of informed consent, because you're not perhaps getting told what kind of things are part of the procedure you're signing on for, because a bias in favor of physical health means that they're just not that important, given the filter. Give me another example. A lot of people not talking. Your participation grade is just plummeting. Oh, right, we're not getting one. But if we were... Seriously? You've never had an informed consent. My God, we're doing a great job. Or you people have never been sick. You've never been witness to or been part of informed consent in process that you thought afterwards, why didn't they tell me that?
I used to work on the head and neck cancer floor, and a lot of patients would have like jaw surgery, removal of oral cancer, and be really disfigured in the hospital for weeks. And I would often ask them if they had known what they would look like, would they have wanted to know? And a lot of them would say no. And they wouldn't have done the surgery if they had known, but they didn't want to know before.
Okay, so that brings us good.
It was a different side of the flip side that there. I often wondered if I had a neck surgeon told them that you're going to have 6 strains coming out of your neck, like a flap from your arm, your leg bone's going to be in your jaw, you're going to be drooling, your tongue's going to be twice the size. And these men would say, it was mostly men, they would say, I wouldn't have done it if I'd known. But the alternative was dying from oral cancer, throat cancer. So.
And it actually is another conundrum in the whole problem of informed consent. Because we've spent the first half hour of the class talking about all the things that some patients want to know but don't get to find out. But there is the other complete side of the coin, which are patients who don't want to really know any of it and are actually being forced to have the information. So give me some examples of that. You just give me a great example. Give me another one. Where a reasonable patient would not want to know. Because, of course, whenever you talk about resisting, if providers pick out some of these things that they are going to be conveying to you in the informed consent procedure, and you resist hearing them, they think then that there's something not connecting here, that some kind of rationality that's not working for you. Because when they pick out the things that they're going to tell you, they think that these are the things you really do have to know. So give me an example of things that's a great one, of a rational person not wanting to know something.
And the rationale here isn't just disfigurement. It's also that dread and fear and anxiety could be, the rationale could be, will prevent me from doing what I would ultimately want to safeguard, which is my health. And so I don't want those emotions that will be engendered by information to actually block me from a decision that would be wise, would be another way of parsing what you're saying, which makes it perfectly rational that they wouldn't have wanted to know. Good.
And I think also, too, like with these types of surgeries, there are so many... the anticipated outcomes, there was such a wide range that patients would be fine, and then right. other patients would be in hyperbaric treatment for 6 months.
Right.
So exactly. I don't think the doctors really could tell people.
Right. Right.
So I think
right.
in that case, they just really didn't disclose.
Okay. Okay.
Really,
and then you can imagine that there will be patients who said, how could you have not told me that this could happen and call that an informed consent if, in fact, I would not have allowed that? So, like, think about, for example, a statistical kind of benefit that is not as large as you will die definitely. So, something like this. Chemotherapy will give you an extra 4% chance of not getting a recurrence. But that but the chemotherapy that you could forego would have various side effects on you, like chemo brain, where maybe you wouldn't, you know, it would have some kind of effect on your cognition long term, or maybe your libido would never recover. Who knows what the side effect could be? Fertility, and you didn't know those things, and you took a 4% increase, a decrease in recurrent risk, but for pretty, in your mind, pretty spectacular hits to what was important to you. So there are times when, you know, to not know is actually to harm yourself pretty significantly, though on a health benefit, you know, on a straight statistical assessment, that 4% might be quite meaningful to a physician. Okay, give me an example again of where a rational person might not want to know something.
Some people might not want to know the things that carry, like, really, really small risks.
Okay.
You know, like, they're often very serious, and there's such a small risk that will happen to you, especially people who maybe are very anxious.
Okay. I remember the intake. My little guy had an ASD. He's fine. He's 10 now. But he had an intake with a fellow. And the intake with the cardiovascular surgeon had, he had said, kids of this health status ride through anesthesia, no problem. He's perfectly healthy. This is an ASD. You've got years to take care of it. He'll be absolutely fine. Shouldn't worry about the anesthesia. The fellow said, well, I know that Dr. So-and-so told you that, but I do want to tell you that you do have a 1 in 250 million chance of death. So I do want to get that on the table. I mean, it was some astronomical bad. Death was the result of the anesthesia, but the number was so minuscule that it was very hard to get your head around. And it certainly wasn't going to be a reason why you would let a kid die of congestive heart failure 20, 30, 40 years from now. And yet, the fellow felt beholden to tell me that there was this statistical risk of, maybe it was 1 in 500,000. But it was a, how do you even think about a risk like that? And of course, you know, I'm getting all upset, and you know. Did I want to know that? I can assure you I didn't. So, so good. That's another example. What else?
Well, I have an example. It's kind of two-parted. I work in critical care, as some of you know, and we have a lot of people on ventilators, and a lot of them are elderly. They can't wean. And so after a period of time, if it appears they're not going to wean, the critical care doctor offers them a tracheostomy, and the surgeon comes, and they do an informed consent for the procedure of the tracheostomy, and everything's fine, and it goes really well. But the beginning part of the informed consent is what happens to the patient after they get their tracheostomy, which is that then you have to go to a long-term vent facility and attempt to be weaned, and if you fail that, you don't ever go home again. So if they don't close that circle in the beginning, people often consent to the trach without knowing what that means for life.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing wrong with the consent procedure in and of itself. These are the risks. We're going to the OR. We're going to do this. That's going to happen. This is how many times I've done it. It's very full. But the meaning is not fully there.
Yeah. So we had a neonatal nurse who made the end probably for very similar reasons, except at the beginning of life rather than in intensive care. She said that the consents that she witnessed day in and day out were
procedure-based, and they were bracketed around a certain parameter of time around the time frame of the procedure. So plus or minus, you know, plus 2 weeks or plus a month. But they didn't talk about what you were actually signing up for that could potentially be years. And that really, if you thought about the deepest meaning of informed consent, you would think that patients or families would want to know how my yes today actually saddles me with a consequence far down the line that I don't have enough knowledge to see, but you do. And that's another big problem in informed consent. Where is the time bracket going to end in terms of what you cover? And many people, and nurses especially, argue that because they're the ones standing there taking care of the consequence of that monumental decision and living at the bedside with patients who didn't know that that's what it was. And there is a lot of concern about whether we're not looking far enough out when we're doing a consent. Okay? One of my favorites is that if there's really no choice, given what any reasonable person would want, then how much information is actually necessary? I'll give you an example. You could have a dead baby, or you could have a C-section. How much discussion of a C-section do you really want? My guess is 100% of people will take the C-section to preserve the outcome of dead baby. So what else do we need to talk about? Recovery process or whatever? You know, maybe if somebody's interested, and not a bad thing to do, I'm simply saying that to force information when a choice seems quite obvious can also make patients feel like, look, that's just one fact too many here when we've got, what, 15 minutes before dead baby? Let's just, like, roll it here. All right. All of these things make us understand that even the most well-meaning provider will have a hard time figuring out what it is exactly that you want to know. There are three standards that people could use. The one would be professional practice. This is what's disclosed in the profession of pick your specialty, pick your discipline, medicine, nursing. This is what we disclose. What would be the downside of the professional practice standard of informed consent? What is it?
It's not targeted to the individual.
Exactly. So one problem would be that it's just a one-size-fits-all. And what we've talked about here is how varied people actually are. You've got people on your floor who didn't want to know about what the outcomes could be. You know there's people in this room who want to know every single possibility. Professional standard, what does that mean? It's just not a one-size-fits-all. And what is reasonable for one person to want to know, like, can I swim? Can I drive? Will I be fuzzy the next day? You know, whatever. It just a one-size-fits-all for the professional practice seems like it's going to miss the mark. Okay, what else? About problematic with professional practice. This is what professionals do. Yeah.
It may be difficult to explain to me professional language.
Okay, and that will affect understanding as well. But if I use the standard of what I want to know as a professional, I may also be using the language and what type of, where the parameters are of how much I need to explain. Because in my profession, this is what, these words have meaning to me, this vocabulary has meaning to me, but it may not have meaning when I'm actually explaining it. Okay? So to use the standard of the profession may get the whose informational standard and quantity of information are we using? Mine as a professional or yours as a patient. Okay, what else? Other problems with the professional standard?
The profession may not really understand what a patient wants.
Okay.
So that may never get to true informed consent.
All right. So it may, especially if once we customize the conception of the good of the healthcare. Let's get a couple of these up here. Let's think about just as we're riffing a little bit on the professional standard. Think about American biomedicine. What are the you know, we use this phrase conception of the good. What do they think? What does the institution consider its highest priorities? The summum bonum. What's the top good? What kind of concerns are fairly universally held? Kind of stock understandings of the world. Give me a couple of them. One is that physical health, uber alles. What else?
Prolonged life.
Okay, right. So increase of life over quality of life until a certain point in time.
And then it's then there's often a decision about a thought in people's mind of, look, what are we doing here? Sure, we can keep a dead body alive, but so there are very distinct moments of what constitutes enough quality of life to keep going and also a priority over getting more life years. That's why when the case of Quill was written up, Diane, a case of individualized decision making that was the basis of the Vacco versus Quill lawsuit that we talked about on the first day, Diane foregoes a 25% chance of recovery from leukemia. And the physicians that she, the oncologist, the hematologist that she was working with, thought she was crazy. Right, they thought she was crazy. And that you would take, you would forego that level of odd to get more years, that you would forego those years. What else is the bias? And bias, again, we all are biased. This is not a slam at all. This is just, let's articulate the worldview of medicine here.
New technology equals good technology.
Okay. New equals good. Great. I don't know if you read Zeke Emanuel's piece a year ago in the New York Times on the proton beam dinger thing that we have over there. I don't think he had the job 2 weeks before he disemboweled Penn for the proton beam thing, whatever it's supposed to do, and he explained all kinds of reasons why he thought it was a terrible, terrible, terrible thing. But, no, everybody here was like, ooh, proton beam, or whatever it was. Okay. Other things. Uh-huh.
Access to all interventions for everyone is good.
All right. Access to all intervention. Good. How do we feel about risk?
Oh, it's always worth it.
What is it?
It's always worth it.
Okay, yeah. So the risks are worth it. But also, if you've got a choice between a higher risk and a lower risk procedure, what do you go with? You think it depends?
Depends on the difference in degrees of, like, the higher risk and the lower risk and the cost, I'd say, as well.
All right.
And the potential outcome.
Okay. So I don't know how to quantify that, so keep all that in mind. there is certainly a concern of, how about this? Don't take unnecessary risks. Would you buy that?
From the provider's perspective?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. This is from the provider's perspective. How do we feel about the homeopathic? You're laughing, so that tells us right there. So it's Western over others. Now, that said, we're seeing some wiggle room. What kind of things would get some respect from allopathic medicine today that wouldn't have gotten respect 25 years ago?
Acupuncture.
Acupuncture is getting some decent respect. That sad article in Archives on yoga and stress management is getting a little bit of nod of, okay, what else?
Tai Chi for Parkinson's patients.
All right, so there's actually some movement here. Right, okay. But in general, when you start talking about your crystals and, you know, whatever, your prayer meetings and everything, it's like, that's right, okay. So anyway, with all of that understood as the conception of the good, we then go to the professional practice standard and we can see that if your conception of the good isn't the one that dovetails perfectly, well, here's another one. Meds are good. So, for example, if there's a medicine that could help the condition you've got, then there's a kind of bias in favor of do the medicine. So that's why half the country's on Prozac. You know, you're unhappy because, you know, you're being worked too hard and there's all kinds of problems. I got a drug for you, as opposed to talk therapy, which has, you know, there is that, but it's medicine is good. That's why my mother-in-law would be a perfect person to have the professional practice standard, because she mirrors this in terms of her view of medicine. That's why she's got 20 pills a day that you have to have one of those big boxes to keep straight. You know, morning, Monday, Tuesday, you know, like all that. Because meds are good, and the more the merrier, and who knows what they interact with, and good luck. So, whereas Autumn doesn't like to take anything. She's even nervous about vitamins. So, Autumn would not probably do very well with the professional practice practice. She's all into voodoo and everything. So if your conception of the good mirrors nicely the medical model, then the professional standard may do you a better service than if you're some whack job who's got basically antithetical views to all of these, and that professional practice standard may not actually dovetail nicely with you. But there's also the problem of what constitutes the professional standard. Tell me about the profession of medicine regionally in the United States. Tell me, is it consistent, inconsistent, overlapping, not overlapping? Tell me about the professional practice standard inside a subdiscipline. So, cardiology. Cardiologists will look at the procedure that they're about to do. They've all got the same view. They all have the same understanding of what works. No, certainly not, right? We've got very good evidence that different parts of the country even practice certain specialties differently. And that means that when you're talking about the professional practice standard, you're really talking about the professional practice standard where? And a region is something that's been clearly demonstrated. For example, certain parts of the country are definitely more pro-bypass surgery than medical management and stuff like that. So that's very clearly proven. But it actually can even be inside a hospital system. This is how we do it. Today I heard, for example, that HUP is laying out a policy now of families being present in codes. Now, you know that it can't be the case that there are hospitals all over America where families are present for codes. So if you end up, if this policy passes, and I do believe it will here in the MICU, you end up in the MICU here, your loved ones will be able to be there when you have a code. And if you go to another hospital, you will be saying, but my uncle, I was with my uncle when he coded. And that hospital will say what to you? First of all, they're going to tell you they don't do it like this here. They may also tell you that they don't do that anywhere. Because the other thing that's very strange about medicine is that while it is very siloed, people often think that they're doing the same thing in every place. It always surprises me how you'll have people say to you, oh, no, they would never do it like that. But you're like, oh, but I know I'm only an N of one, but I know that's how they did it because I was there. Like, for example, at HUP, they don't put lidocaine before an IV. At the Brigham and Women, that's standard fare, lidocaine before an IV. You won't get people around here to believe that they would do that. How about this? You'll read on the internet before an amnio, they give lidocaine before an amnio. You ask here to get lidocaine before an amnio, they're like, I don't understand that. Nobody would do that because that's crazy business. You're going to get one stick for the amnio and one stick for the lidocaine, or just one stick for the amnio. Why would anyone in the world do that? And if you look on the internet and they explain the procedures for amnio, many, many, many places will tell you that they do lidocaine before an amnio. Okay, what's the point of that? The point is that professional practice standard, if it could meet the needs of patients, which I doubt, who the heck knows what it would actually mean for a professional standard to actually be there. Okay, what about the reasonable person standard? That's the standard where I decide what to tell you as a provider based on what any reasonable person would want to know. What would be the problem with that? What?
You have to define what a reasonable person is.
Let's just say you're mentally sound, you've got an IQ above 22, smarter than my Bijan, I don't know. You know, we could say what a rational person is. We could define it. I don't know how we would, because that would be very tricky. But what would other downsides be, even if we could locate the rational person?
It doesn't apply to everyone. Not everybody fits that mold.
So, now you could mean a couple of things by that. You could mean not everybody's rational. Some people are nut jobs. But I imagine that isn't what you actually mean.
Not really.
Okay, I mean, if that's what you mean, that's probably true. But if you're a nut job, and I'm using a reasonable person standard, then it's I don't say to myself, no, what would Sue want to know? Well, no, Sue's a whack job. What would Autumn want to know? She's rational. So, of course, anybody who's not rational, we just wouldn't use them as the standard. You'd use Autumn as the standard, because obviously I must be rational, at least in some understanding, because I'm up here with concepts and conception of the good. I mean, there has to be something track in here. I've got the gas off my head. I mean, usually. So I don't think that it can be, yes,
you
that would be true.
To treat that.
What?
Person who is irrational.
Yeah, I mean, no, definitely. I mean, one downside would be, so
So you guys are nut jobs. I still have to try to meet your needs, even if you're nuts. Okay, so that could be. I think there may be a deeper problem with it, or at least an additional problem than that, but I agree with you.
It may give the physician too much discretion as to what he's going to tell, he or she's going to tell the patient at any given time.
But if you just think to yourself, what would the rational person want to know?
I think it could be affected with someone's values, like someone in this United States may value things differently from someone who comes from another country, government or something.
Okay, and I actually think the problem is broader than you're saying it is. You're saying, well, look, we all live in the United States, at least at this moment we do, and yet some people come from here and some people come from here, and what's rational to one isn't rational to another because they might come from a different place. I agree with you, but I think the problem is 100-fold worse than that. Even if every one of us came from Berwick, Pennsylvania, and I don't recommend it, I can promise you that what you want to know and what I want to know on certain dimensions aren't the same thing. For example, on the C-section, I didn't want to know a damn thing. I was like, get the baby. I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it. I don't care. And I actually thought I was quite rational. It's 10 years later, I still think that was rational. It seemed perfectly rational to me to have no choice whatsoever and to want to know nothing about it. It doesn't seem irrational to me to not want to know what the men didn't want to know on the head and neck floor. But some of you would be like, I don't care how much time it takes. I want to know everything. Does that mean that one of us isn't rational? Probably not. It means that we have different values. We have different conceptions of the good. Different things matter to us, and different things matter to us at different times. So the idea that there would be a reasonable person standard imagines that pure rationality would dictate what you ought to tell me. But actually, we could all be quite rational and want very different things. For example, I got to tell you, I never care about cost. Why do you think I don't care about cost?
You have really good insurance.
I have really good insurance. And I can handle the deductibles just fine. And that I am very thankful for. I don't care about it. And if you bothered me with it, especially if I wasn't feeling well, I would be like, can we move on? That's what insurance is for. That would be rational because I happen to be well off. I wasn't when I was a grad student and I would have cared. So even what I need to know at a certain time would have varied very distinctly.
Okay. There are lots of things that you want to know that I don't want to know, and vice versa on every one of those dimensions. And yet, I'm just going to go out on a limb here, that we're all rational. If you got the cats on your head, tell me now. Okay? I mean, we did have a guy, he did look quite normal, come to my office, and he seemed like, again, he was playing with the full deck, when he said, you know, we've met before, and I'm here for the meeting. Like, you know, just remind me of... sorry, I'm not that good with faces. He's like, yeah, because I'm trying to get 10,000 feet of lab space for the rats. I thought, okay, well, that makes sense. This is the science center after all. I do look like Melissa Gilbert. There's probably somebody else you're trying to talk to. He's like, that's right, because the perambulation of NFL, when they had the stickums on their arm, tar on the arm, that was the true travesty indeed. And that's the rats. But he did look quite normal in his opener. Did seem. I'm going to venture. And you know, he told the security guard after, I was like, I'll be right back. He told the security guard what really got him was when that woman started talking about stickums. Can you imagine being treated like that? I'll write the name of the science center manager on a stickum. The stickum. Not a piece of paper.
Okay, but I'm going to venture to guess that none of you are in that particular place right now. And so reasonable standard, given that we all want different things, seems like you're probably not going to get it right. Because if you get what this reasonable person wants, you didn't get what this reasonable. All right, obviously then there's only one less subjective standard. That would be great, but the problem is...
how do you know what that is? Do you have enough time to do it? And even if you have enough time, you desperately want to do it, have there been things that you didn't want to know that you wanted to know until you knew you didn't know them? You see what I'm saying? You don't know what it is you want to know until the very thing that you had to know you didn't get to know. And I'll tell you one. I'm terrible with anesthesia. And so I remember having an endoscopy years ago. This is back when they thought GERD should be diagnosed with an endoscopy. Obviously, they didn't read the archives paper. But at any rate, didn't have it. It's all great, but it doesn't matter. They gave me the anesthesia for this endoscopy, and they didn't tell me that even 24 hours later, I would not be, like, quick on the draw. But philosophers need to be very quick on their feet. not like, can you repeat that? You know. So even if I told them, I'm a philosopher, so we're using the subjective standard, they wouldn't say to themselves, well, then I got to tell you, I hope you're not giving any talks tomorrow. Even if they knew the subjective standard, even if they knew I was a philosopher, they might not know to tell me that, because especially if it doesn't happen to everybody, I wouldn't know to ask it. How is the subjective standard going to work? It's not that it's not a good ideal. It's that it's just very hard. A lot of times, what your values are the things that are identifiable the first time when they're stepped on. When you can't swim, when you didn't know your libido would be effective, when you didn't know you'd go home with drains, those are things you subjectively cared about, but you didn't have enough information, or you couldn't predict it, or they couldn't predict it. Altogether, disclosure is mired in difficulty, even when everybody's trying very, very hard. Well, good, because we're on the first element of informed consent, and it's already feeling like a pretty hard bar to meet. What about understanding? What are the problems with understanding? I mean, that's not, and I don't mean, you know, you got your people who've got a low IQ, and I'm just talking about us. People like us, just let's just, not that we're people plus or minus us, but, you know, basically, what are the problems with understanding? Give me some of those.
Like you said before, it's hard to understand statistics.
Okay, one problem is statistics themselves. What are you supposed to do with the 1 in 200, the 1 in 250,000, the 50%? How are you supposed to understand that? So it's not that you couldn't repeat back, parrot. You could even say, oh, I know what 50% means. It means if we counted off 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, all the 1s would have and the 2s wouldn't. It's not like you're too dumb to understand what 50% is. It's that you don't know what to do with it once you've got it. I mean, that means I could be a 1, I could be a 2. Right. So understanding and statistics, even when you know the literal meaning, very hard to process. Okay, what else?
Well, you just sort of said it. When you know the literal meaning, sometimes people don't know what the literal meaning is, and they're embarrassed to ask.
All right, so there may be some common words that people use. I'll give you some. I was just at the HUP ethics meeting, I told you that, sitting next to a cardiologist, and I was saying that he knows this, but I was saying something about my son's ASD, or that anecdote had come up or whatever, and he said, oh no, I totally understand, because my son had a blah, blah, blah. Now, the reason I know what an ASD is because, a septal defect, you know, atrial septal defect. The reason I know that is because my son had it. Do you think I know every congenital abnormality in the heart? But if you throw out the word ASD, well, now we're with among peers, aren't we, folks? So he threw out some word. Some of you know it. I don't know what it was. And I was like, right, right. I hope that wasn't a bad thing. So you may know some words and not others. But there's another level of what you're saying. Sometimes you know a word, but you don't know what its implications are. So you don't know what its long-term consequences are. You don't have any judgment that attaches to it. Like leukemia. Okay, all right, I know what leukemia is, but I don't know anything about survival rates, prognosis, what time you get it, how many types there are. So sometimes even knowing a word doesn't help you know all the surrounding information that may or may not be getting explained to you. Okay?
Denial, or you have previous conceptions. If you have cancer, it means you're already sick and falling apart. You only use 10% of your brain. Why do I need to have all of it if you're having some sort of procedure? Just like misconceptions about.
All right, lots of different things you're saying there. One is denial. So I can be filtering what you're saying and be like, yeah, mm-hmm, and not really getting it. Sometimes because what you're worried about isn't what I'm worried about. Sometimes it truly is because I refuse to accept something that you're naming as truth and I'm not naming it as truth. But then there are other implications that I just can't see. Like you said, well, you would lose 10% of your brain function or whatever. And I might be saying, well, I don't see why that would be so bad. I mean, I got a whole lot left, or, you know, because I don't have enough information or depth of context to really see what that means. Okay, good.
There's also a strong desire to please.
Okay.
Involved by the person.
Yes.
Consent. Your mother, the good patient.
Yes, I was just going to. My mother-in-law. I was just going to mention her. As a matter of fact,
the good patient, because you know she's going to give all authority and autonomy over to the provider, right, and not ask a lot of questions. And whatever doctor says, I'm going to do it. And when questions probably should be asked.
Well, that's why you'll ask her afterwards. So he said what? Oh, yeah, no, I didn't ask that. Well, did you ask this? No. Do you think I should have? Well, if you were me, you would have. But, you know, yes. So, and partly that is, it's a funny dichotomy. Patients are kind of stuck in, because on the one hand, gosh, if you get under everybody's skin, then you're the difficult patient. So you don't want that because you know there's bad consequences to that. But then you can hyper-please. And hyper-please may mean I just, you know, I didn't want to bother her. She was so busy and she was so kind. And I just didn't want to keep pummeling her with questions. So that can be a problem with understanding because I really don't know what you're saying. But, gosh, you spent a lot of time with me and I really don't think I should be pressing it. Okay, good. What else?
Sometimes you can be so emotionally upset that you hear an initial thing and you never hear anything that follows.
Right, exactly. And part of that could be from, I think what you were saying with is your past experience and your past history. So it could be that anybody in the world would be upset. Pancreatic cancer, you're pretty much going to be upset. But there could be other things that you would be not as upset if you didn't have a certain preconception or a certain kind of understanding, like basal cell skin cancer. I mean, you know, you got like 100% odds there. But if your understanding of cancer is just cancer and cancer means death and everybody who gets it, you've just already heard the cancer and you just can't go any further.
They can't process information that's coming beyond that.
I mean, right, I'm focusing on that. Right, exactly. I think a lot of us have been with people or have had that experience. Another thing about your preconceptions is, and I'll definitely ask it, get yours, but You may be worried that you're going to hear that you have X. You find out you have Y. Now, Y may not be so good, but at least it's not X. I'll give you this example. I was with my best friend whose mother had some type of cardio thing, and I can't remember what. I can't remember what it was that we were worried that it was. Cancer, probably, or something or other. And this is going to have a good ending because she's fine still, and this was 20-some years ago. But I remember when the cardiologist told us that she had this and not that. Our expression on our face was just like really happy, and he was just like, okay, obviously people are retarded because I am telling you that she has a very serious illness that you seem to not be taking seriously. Well, I'm like, I mean, today I even look back and I'm like, well, I don't know, that was like 1994. How serious were we supposed to take it? She's still here. I mean, if she had had the thing we were feared, she would have been dead in 1996. But sort of, you know, our preconceived notions about what we were worried she had made us filter what she did have in a sort of Pollyannish, well, great, you know, kind of, you know, mode. All right, I know you had one. Was it you?
For me, it was just like, whenever I go to the doctor and the examiner room, if they say, do you have any questions to understand everything? I'm like, yeah, in that moment, I have no questions. But then I go home and I'm like, oh, I forgot to ask this.
Right.
Oh, I didn't think about that. And it's like, you know, based on that moment, there was full understanding, but I didn't even know what.
Because you didn't have enough time to think through, well, gosh, I really don't know the answer to this question or that question. And only in retrospect do you think about it. I think another phenomenon of the when I'm asked, well, do you have any questions? Do your grocery stores say to you when you get to the checkout line, did you find everything you needed?
No.
You know you didn't. Okay, you know that they've always switched the aisles. They were out of the pumpkin. Well, that's when you're going to bring it up. Because what are they? You know, you're not. You're going to like, yeah, I say this. I hate lying, and I hate grocery stores, and every time I see the checkout person, yeah, definitely. Why? I don't know. So if I'm asked, did you get all the information you needed? Yep, absolutely. Especially if I'm annoyed with you. I'm like, okay, you're a jerk. Yep, got everything I need. So another problem of understanding is whatever that phenomenon is, that we're just like, I don't think you care to answer my questions. You say you do. I don't think you do. So I'm not going to say that I don't know. I'm just going to go to my WebMD and all my friends. You know, I've got this huge network now, all these people who know something, and screw you. So, okay, that's another problem of understanding. What else affects understanding? Anything else?
If we say, I mean, is a given your educational level, your...
Yeah, definitely. And you could have educational level sky high on one aspect, but not on another. And I'll give you an example, too. My husband has a PhD in chemistry, and he's in R&D. He's a drug-eluting stent specialist. So he knows quite a bit about one arena of medicine and chemistry, But once you get past that arena, medicine and chemistry, he doesn't know anything. But physicians talk to him like, you know, he's just one of the flock. I'm not sure why, because it's not an MD, people. It's a PhD, and it's chemistry. Yeah, he can kick ass on orgo. But how's that going to help when it comes time to endoscopies or who knows what? So another part of the educational problem is that unless you've got a specialized knowledge about something, you could be assumed to have more. So one of your problems would just be, look, I just, you know, I have a second grade reading level, so I can't read the form you're actually telling. That's one kind of obvious way. But then there's other ways in which education plays out in consent forms where you might look like you have more education than you do. And even a lot of times we'll do, some of you have been in the mediation intensives, but we do role plays with clinical cases. And we've got a lot of nurses and doctors who come to this intensive. But what I always find interesting is that among internal to specialists, so nurses or physicians, there is a lot of depth of expertise in the area of the discipline they're from. But sometimes there's remarkable lack of expertise in disciplines they're not from. Like, you know, I should try to think of an example, because I'm always sometimes stunned at what an MD or nurse doesn't know about a specialty that's not theirs, which actually just proves how deep the knowledge is inside one specialty.
Well, the example I'll give is, you know, I do high-risk obstetrics, and so we oftentimes, because women, pregnant women can get brain aneurysms that rupture fairly commonly, so we deal with the neurosurgeons, not uncommonly. And they are a group of people, I mean, I know nothing about neurosurgery, nothing, but they know nothing about obstetrics.
Right.
And I one day got a phone call because the neurosurgeon wanted to do an arteriogram, but the patient's pregnancy test came back positive, and the quantitative beta was 8. And he didn't want to do the arteriogram because she was pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the phone call from his fellow. And I was like, really? You're talking about 3 cells that maybe are holding on to nothing in the uterus. But it's just an
exactly.
example of,
exactly.
and clearly you wouldn't want me to clip your aneurysm.
Right.
But, you know,
exactly.
you've sort of been
right.
in a little world.
Exactly. And that is another problem of understanding, because when you're inside your own flock, there's a presumption that, you know, look, we're all on the same knowledge plane, which maybe you were in MS3, you know, but at this point, all right. So understanding has all kinds of problems. Moving on. Voluntariness, let's talk about how, of course, obviously if I put a gun to your head and I say sign it, that would be coercive. But tell me some other ways that informed consent procedures can be coercive, even if the provider, the nurse or the physician, is not trying to do harm, has your interests at heart in a very sincere way. How could consent look not as voluntary as one might hope?
Like, if a patient don't have any other choice, he has to accept what is being provided. Like, this is the only treatment you have, or this is the only what you can afford, so you have no choice of selecting or choosing another.
Okay, so now tell me how, I mean, you're definitely, I definitely hear what you're saying where I simply can't access this choice. I just can't afford it. So I have to take this choice. But tell me how the informed consent procedure itself would be coercive in a context like that.
It's like when a physician tells you, provided you are insurance plan, what you can afford here is just this one. So will you choose it or not? And you don't have more money to go for all the pay for some more services. I don't know if it is coercive or I feel like it may be.
So the only question I have there is the finance what's coercive or is the process coercive? But I hear what you're saying. Let's think about times when the process itself is coercive, because there's no doubt about it. Finances can be coercive. They force people's hand to take a choice that may not be optimal for that person. So there's no doubt about it. Finances can be coercive. So the question is, give some examples where the process, though, is coercive. Give me an example of how that would work.
You could say, like, if we're going to do this, we have to do it now.
Okay. Yeah. Time pressure. We do a case in mediation where it's built on the, it must be done now. But if you get some OB people, OB-GYN people, and you really, it's an OB-GYN case, but if you press them, they'll say, yeah, we probably have, I don't know, 20 hours or, you know, I don't know, something that is certainly not right now, that the case is written as a right now kind of case. So one question is, right now, based on what? If there's absolutely no risk that you're allowing in your mind, we don't want to have any risk at all, then maybe there's no time. But if there's a 1% risk, a 3% risk, a 5%, some small quantity of risk, maybe there's more time. Or maybe even 100% risk, it's not right now. It's at some point, but soon. So that would be coercive. I agree.
Can I have a spin on that? I was recently coerced into having a mole removed. And it was given kind of the context of, like, I could do it right now in this appointment, or you could, like, come back and pay the money for a new one.
By then, it'll be a melanoma. It probably will spread. I mean, I can't be responsible.
And also, like, the whole way that moles are coded is, like, they're on a scale, so you can't really tell how serious it really is. And, you know, the doctor just wants to, like, remove anything they can for the extra $100 or $1,000.
My dermatologist had a funny story about that. She works at Penn, and she's so overworked. She's like, you know, I'll tell you how to pick a dermatologist, one who has no time to take off moles. Because the only moles they're going to take off are the ones that they're like, oh, my God! You know, because other than that, they're like, look, I don't have time for this. So, but I hear exactly. I had a similar coercive experience. My daughter has a scar, and she has a scar because when she was 4 months old, the dermatologist made it sound like, you know, God knows we could have baby death here from whatever this rash was if we didn't have it biopsied. It was eczema, and she, for the rest of her life, will have a scar because, hello, thank you, she blames me every day, because I felt like I had, I mean, I'm a mom, and I just couldn't let, you know, baby rash, you know kill my kid of eczema or whatever. In hindsight, it's funny, but not to her. But it's the same kind of coercive mechanism, but this time, instead of time rush or, you know, the delay or whatever, it's, you know, the stakes are so high. And that's how I felt. And I couldn't, I was like, what I should have said was, well, what kind of death by baby rash do you think we could have? But it's one of those understanding moments where you're just so emotionally, like, overwrought that you can't use your rational mind to say, well, now, why don't you tell me what the worst case scenario here is? And if eczema was the answer, I would have been like, I'm out of here. So, all right, I do. That is a perfect example of coercion. Anytime somebody is steering you, but steering you by ways that feel a little manipulative. Either they're telling you there's no time, they're telling you the disease is dreadful, they're telling you, you know, insurance won't pay, I don't know. Any others?
Okay. I was saying, like, I mean, I work in a neuro ICU now, and it's, I mean, patients, literally, they don't give, wheeling them to the OR to take off their skull, and they're calling the family. So they don't really get a chance to give them all the risks of the procedure, or like she was saying earlier, with the trachs and the ventilators, like, yes, we're going to take off one part of your skull, but then it's really not going to make a difference in the outcome. Mm-hmm. So,
nope. Okay.
They don't really.
All right.
I think a lot of the families, if they can see 3 weeks later, the patient is still not awake, and I mean, that's kind of voluntary. They don't really have a choice, really. A lot of times in those cases, sometimes they don't even get consent.
Right.
Because it's literally, we're going to die in 20 minutes. Or,
all right. Okay, all those are great examples of voluntariness. Now, that was all presupposing that the person is actually competent, which sometimes patients aren't. And they can be not competent because they're not conscious. You have to be conscious to be competent. That's probably obvious. But even when you are conscious, you have to, you can talk about the perambulation of the NFL's stick'em problem and be competent if you can talk about the risks and benefits of this particular procedure and the alternatives and explain, you know, even in a small way, what it is that you want. So even the cats on my head isn't necessarily a disqualifier of competence, has to be situation specific. But clearly, there are times when you're awake, but you're not competent, or you are just not awake, and so you're certainly not competent. And then we have to kick in with surrogate decision making. Three standards for surrogate decision making: substituted judgment, pure autonomy, best interest. Let's start with substituted judgment. Substituted judgment is where I try to get into the mind of my loved one, and I try to say, well, what would Paul want? So I'm trying to guess what Paul would want. What kind of odds do you have of getting it right when you guess? Before you answer, let me tell you about an experiment. They partnered people up with their surrogates. So they found out, you know, okay, so Autumn and Paul, Susie and Judy, you know, Tom and Bob, whatever. Paired people up. And then they split them into two groups. So you had one half of the surrogate pair and the other. One was the patient and, you know, whatever, and one was the pretending to be surrogate. And then they give them a scenario. So, Jody, if such and such happened to you, what would you want done? And then they said to Jody's surrogate, Judy, Judy, what do you think should be done in, what do you think that Jody would want as such and such? And then they looked at how often the surrogates got right what the potential patients, so it's a faux experiment, but still, it's pretty telling. What do you think the odds were that the surrogates got it right? 50-50. Exactly. Okay, that's pretty bad because that's flip a coin level. So you think you've got the surrogate really trying to get your head and actually you got 50-50. So surrogate substituted judgment as a surrogate decision-making process has problems. Again, what we're trying to talk about here is all the problems of informed consent. All right, let's talk about pure autonomy. Pure autonomy is where you've got direct evidence from the patient herself. So there is an advance directive. There is a journal entry. There is some kind of, you know, we were at a bar and I was talking about Nancy Cruzan and I said, if I get an accident tonight, I don't want to be on food and hydrated. You know, there's some kind of statement from the patient herself prospectively. Somehow there was some kind of indication. Now that seems like a slam dunk winner for what patients want. And yet, if we actually scratch the surface a little bit of pure autonomy, we find that it's not as simple as that. Not that I'm saying we should throw out advanced directives, for heaven's sake, but I am saying that, and R. Kaplan actually is on record as saying things like, we should just get rid of them. Now, I'm not taking that position at all. I'm simply trying to talk about what the logic is. Oh, he's got this feet thing on again.
I've been hiding them like
that. What I'm trying to talk about is the logic for the worry, logic behind Art's position. How is it that it's not just straightforward? I wrote it in advance directive and by God do it. Tell me why it's not so connect the dots, so obvious correlation.
They're very general.
They're general. So they don't say, well, you've had the vent, but you've had it for 6 days, and one doctor's saying 20%, and the other one's saying 10%, and or, you know, whatever. They're just general and impressionistic. And they say things like, no hope of recovery, or something like that. But recovery on what term? By what standard? I mean, we already know, because Autumn says it every class she teaches, that if Autumn's not going to be able to teach philosophy, that's not recovery, so might as well just unplug me. So that is not what everybody would think recovery actually means. Some people will mean, my eyes are open, and I'm, you know, nodding my head, like, you know, giving a one or a two, you know, for yes and no. I mean, and that's recovery. So what recovery is, and the form doesn't really tell that. So yes, partly they're vague. Okay, what else?
It reflects what you think you would do in that circumstance, not necessarily what you would do.
Okay, so I'm here, and I'm saying that this is what I will do. If this happens, if I become quadriplegic, I want to make sure you don't save me. Kill me right there in the emergency room because I don't want to be a quadriplegic. But the problem is that until I'm a paraplegic or a quadriplegic, I don't know whether I can find integrity in a life like that, and maybe I can. So I'm telling you right here while I'm moving all my limbs that I don't want to live like that, but I'm not sure what kind of a testimonial that is if I actually, God forbid, would find myself in that position. Because I may not know what that experience is like and what I feel about that experience until I'm in that experience. Okay, that's good. What else? Why else?
Mm-hmm. I think just parlaying into the bigger idea of competence. A lot of this stuff is written with a legal lexus that people really don't understand, or they have to sit down with an attorney and have them understand it. And I mean, a lot of times people really don't know what they're saying or like what they're signing to.
All right, so I don't know the implication. All right, so I said it, but I didn't know that it meant this, that, and the other thing. I didn't know that that was its ramification. Okay? Why else can't you take?
Well, I don't know if this is what you're looking for, but they usually appoint a surrogate person to make the decision, and that person may not be competent to make the decision. I say, you know, if something happens to me, I want you to make my decisions for me. But she may be unaware, unwilling, unable, and the decisions aren't going to get made.
All right. So that's more of a problem with substituted judgment. So that's good. I like that. We added that one. Pure autonomy is so I agree, and I've just added that to our concern about substituted judgment. Okay. On pure autonomy, what did you want to add?
Things change. So like beliefs,
medical technology.
Okay.
Life situations.
Okay. So in the absence of this piece of information, I did say that I wanted that. But now that I would, if I had had this piece of information, I wouldn't have said that, or there's now this new development, or there's this new competing concern. A paper I'm writing right now is about how this classic debate between families and patients with advanced directives, where the advanced director says, if the situation is futile or whatever that language is, please withdraw care. But if you told me, so if you said to me, just thinking about yourself, Autumn, just thinking about whether you would want to live if you would never regain consciousness, you know that I would say I absolutely would not want to live if I couldn't regain consciousness. I wouldn't want to live. That's what I'd say. If I were only thinking about me. But that may be because I didn't know that my paycheck would continue to come to my kids if I never get awake, but my heart still beats, but Penn won't pay me once my heart stops beating, and so to keep me, I would never have elected to have an advanced directive that would say, pull the plug if I'm not going to be awake, if I had known that to do that would actually sabotage my ability to support my kids. So I make that decision based on my own health care, but that's because I didn't know that there was this fact in the world about how I might be able to meet my obligations to my children. Or, here's another fact that's even, I think, even more pressing. They just don't want me to be dead. They want me alive, even if I'm unconscious. If they could articulate that to me, and, you know, I'm not suffering, I mean, of course you can say you're suffering, even though we don't know people are suffering, maybe they are suffering, fine. But when you see people unconscious, I don't know, I mean, maybe you think they're suffering, but if they're highly medicated, highly sedated, maybe there is a sense in which they're suffering, but that's fine by me. You can let me sit and suffer at that level if it's comforting to my kids. I'll stay there for years. If that's what they would like of me, that's fine. I'm a mom. I'll do that. That's not a problem. But if I only think about my health care, I'd be like, are you kidding me? Before I have kids, I told every class, pull the plug. Now I say, pull the plug unless Tali or Ben think it's a good idea not to pull the plug. If they want me alive as a body, just lay in there, and that's good for them, in some way at all, leave me alone. Well, wait, I was rational in both cases, but I could have made that advance directive because I didn't think about whether they might want that. Again, a problem with pure autonomy, because it makes it sound as if when I said pull the plug, I really was thinking all things considered. But maybe when I made that decision, I was really only thinking about one variable and not all the others that may in the end become important to me. You're squinting. Why?
Because I don't think that Tali and Ben should have the right to want that.
Well,
they can want it, but I don't think they have the right to have it. I think that you have to have your own. In this one case, it really should be about you.
You think that, but that may be because of your own conception of the good. Okay. Let's imagine that my conception of the good is that what my children need, if it's not causing me any physical suffering, which you pretty much admitted that we have no evidence that a highly sedated person is suffering physically enormously. You agree to that?
I do. Yes, I have agreed to that.
Okay, do you agree to that? So what if my conception of the good is this? If it's not hurting me physically, my conception of the good is I defer to what my children need, even if they didn't need it, I wouldn't do it. But isn't that my conception of the good?
Is there need for you to be ahead in the bed is that in their best interest?
I don't know. But my worldview is that it doesn't matter to me if that's ultimately better for their grieving process, or maybe they should just let me go, or maybe their psychological well-being. What if my conception of the good is this? If that's what they think they need, I'm happy to give it to them. If that's my conception of the good, I might have signed an advance directive not thinking about that. But now that I know that, I'm like, oh my gosh, just leave me there. And certainly my finance case, if you work at Penn for 7 years, your children get the Penn education benefit, which is 70% off of Penn's tuition and 40% anywhere, for the rest of their life. If you die after 7 years, not if you quit, you know, if you go work for Columbia, then, you know, you're screwed. But I mean, if you work for Penn for up to 7 years, and then you die, your kids get the benefit, no matter how long later they need the benefit. So let's say I've been working at Penn for 6 years, and I have the catastrophic brain injury.
In no world would I want you to unplug me for that year until we hit the 7-year mark, folks. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm not saying it's fair to the system. I'm not saying I'm a good person. I'm saying it's the truth. So again, the pure autonomy standard could be misleading because it makes my testimonial look like it's got the direct truth value of God to Moses on the tablet, which we could question. But it certainly doesn't have that kind of status for all the reasons you're talking about. All right, then that leaves us the best interest standard, and that's the standard of, well, now what would be in the patient's best interest? Now, what would be the problem with that? Patient's best interest. Let's use that.
Who would know, particularly if you want your kids to keep you?
Exactly. I mean, really, we've got her arguing it is not in Autumn's best interest to be kept alive for a year as a vegetable so that her kids could go to college. She's arguing, I should take care of myself. This is the time for Autumn to care about it. So in your idea of the best interest for Autumn, it's like, but I swear I would haunt you. I would haunt you from beyond if you pulled the plug before the 7-year. Now, I've been working for 10, so I'm in the clear. But I'm simply saying that the best interest is very hard to understand because so much of what is in the best interest of the patient has to do with their own conception of the good. And we don't all have the same conception of the good. Now, that's not the same question as, is it good for the economy? Is it good for healthcare allocation? Those are big questions. But I'm simply saying, what is in the best interest of the patient, that is often in the eye of the beholder of the patient herself and is very hard to access. Altogether, then, we get to Veach. Who's like, screw it. We just got to abandon informed consent because it is not working. I'm not taking his side. I'm simply saying I've set us up now to understand that whether we keep it or we don't keep it, it is nothing if it's not complicated. All right, let's talk about Veach, and then let's wrap up the semester. Veach is worried that while we have sold ourselves a bill of goods, that this is an ecumenical, democratic, lateral decision-making process, that in fact, it's quite a hierarchical, in fact, authoritarian mode of decision-making. That's pretty shocking. Because he is part of the MD flock, and he most certainly does not think that MDs are trying to coerce patients, and he doesn't think that MDs don't and RNs don't have the patient's deepest interests at heart and are trying to meet those needs. That is not why he says this. So you tell me, why, given all you know now about informed consent, could he honestly think that informed consent is authoritarian and hierarchical as a process? Because it's touted as being very democratic as a process.
The MD has a lot more information than the other party, so it is authoritarian because they hold all the...
Okay, so one reason is that despite every good intention on my part to give you everything you need, I am the one giving you what you need. And even when you ask me questions, I'm still the one giving it out. I'm still the one that's behind the steering wheel here. I drive the conversation. Even when you ask me for information, I have it. I filter it through who I am. I filter it through my experience. I hand it out. So I'm the one who dishes it out. And anybody who's in the position of dishing it out is in the power position, even when they're trying their best to say, let's all sit down and talk. There's still a power position of I'm the one handing it out. And that gives me the reins, and that gives me the authority. Okay, that's right. What else? Anything else? What else about this hierarchical? How about this? The way, and we've talked about this, the way in which I convey the information to you will never be neutral. Because human beings are not neutral. Human beings come from vantage points. I have seen procedure X done, and I think it never works. I care about you deeply. I'm not going to want you to do X. I'm going to want you to do Y. And I'm going to sculpt the information in favor of Y, not because I am a boss, not because I'm on a power trip, but because I honestly don't think X will work for you. I don't. But that means that I am the one who's shaping the information. Unless I truly do think, Bausch and Lomb, Allergan, who gives a crap? Sure, then I'll say, well, look, you could use either one. And people will say that. They'll say, these two forms of birth control pills, I think, are just as good as each other. Sure, they say that, but that's not even neutral, because that's saying, I think they're the same. And that is already a value judgment on my part. I think they're equally good is a value judgment. There is no information that doesn't come through a value judgment. And so if I'm the one as the provider who's making all the value judgments, I am, again, the one steering the conversation. And that is hierarchical, even though I'm not intending it to be. My own judgment and experience shapes it.
Is it a safe assumption to say it's because it's hierarchical that's not ideal?
Well, I think what he wants to say is maybe hierarchical is ideal, but then let's not pretend it's lateral decision-making. Right? Maybe the ideal is just to admit. In fact, I think when we get to his solution of communities of deep moral values, I think that he's going to talk about how you and I have the same values, and so the way that I'm going to filter the information to you is going to be very much in accord with the way that you think. You, for example, like to minimize risk. You think meds are good. You want to try new technologies. You know, you think that Western medicine should be tried, and it's the one that's got most of the power. Let's say our value systems overlap perfectly. Well, then the way that I filter the information will not rob you of anything, his view is. It will actually give you exactly the kind of information you want. That's the idea with it. Go ahead.
But the fallacy associated with that is that individuals who identify themselves as a something don't necessarily share those same deep values. And your values going into a decision-making process can change when it goes from a theoretical to a reality.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
The paper was an interesting argument, but the fallacy is it's an impossible task to find an individual who 100% or a system, let alone an individual, that will 100% be in concert with your values.
Okay, and let's talk first about, and then we'll talk about some of these other things. We've talked a lot about the MDs versus the patient's conception of the good. I do want to talk about this idea of competing interests, but let's go with what you're talking about here for a minute. What would be the most obvious low-hanging fruit matchup values-wise?
Well, I give you an example. I mean, one of the hospitals I go to is a Catholic hospital.
Yeah, that's God love the Catholic Church, because in discussions like this, we're always trotting them out because it seems like it's going to be obvious.
So it's a Catholic hospital. People should know what they're going to get when they get there in terms of information.
Or what you're not going to get.
Or what you're not going to get.
Right.
But people who come to the Catholic hospital are not all Catholic. So it's a misconception on the part of the providers to think that the individuals who are walking through the door
have already
sort of ilk, because they don't.
Right.
And the second part of it is not all Catholics necessarily feel the same way about all theologized principles.
You can be stronger than that. The overwhelming majority of Catholics believe in birth control. A sizable minority believe in abortion.
Correct.
Almost 100%, I mean really, really high percentages believe in IVF, even if there are leftover embryos, which they find to be quite sad, but they think that having children and a family is so much more important, and that's kind of the sad byproduct. I mean, that is your contemporary American Catholic position is all over the frickin' place. We have priests in the program. Priests! Are all over. Priests can be pro-stem cell. I mean, so part of the problem that we use the Catholic Church because the Catholic's hierarchy has named so definitively many sexual-related, reproductive-related policies, but the rank-and-file Catholics are all over a spectrum.
But
so
even if you think you're a die-hard rank-and-file Catholic, follow everything. Once presented with the decision-making process,
mm-hmm.
you don't necessarily...
Right.
To what you thought were your values.
Right. When you think you're full-on fertile, it may be easier to say, I'd never do IVF. And after you've tried everything and you still can't conceive and you desperately want that child, you might say, confession on Sunday and IVF on Saturday.
You never thought you would have an abortion.
Right.
But you have an amniocentesis for information reasons only and find out you're carrying a child with a chromosome abnormality. Mm-hmm. And then you start to think of my two other children, my marriage and what it means, mm-hmm. and the suffering for the child and who's going to take care of them when I'm dead and gone.
and you might make a very hard decision that you never thought you'd make.
Right. And your point here in a bigger picture is this. If we can't make it work with Catholicism, how are we going to make it work with those of us who don't subscribe to a political tradition, faith tradition, value system that can easily be named? Like, okay, so I'm a freak Democrat Unitarian, as somebody actually nailed me for on the course evaluations and said that socialism has no place in bioethics, so I admit it. I am freak left Unitarian, and I apologize to the right wing person who's upset about it. But at least I'm honest. How am I going to find the physician hookup, the nurse match to that? I mean, and even if I did, would that help me? I'll give you an example of kind of a value system I really need, which is why I am the difficult patient, which is why I write about it. But I remember a physician saying, I was talking about how I like when we can think out of a box, when we say, all right, well, will this paradigm work for this patient? Or, is there any way we can wiggle? And as a mediator, that's the stance I take on everything. Where can we push on the margins? And the physician said to me, no, Autumn, you don't ever want to violate the standard of care, because the standard of care is the thing that has been tested. And there's a reason why if your kid has open heart surgery, they're in the ICU for 2 days, and then they move to a step down for 1 day, and then God knows what. There's a reason why everything is always done the same, because that's tried and true. I was getting the hives as the guy was talking. I'm so not like that. Everything about every fiber in my being speaks against that. But I can understand why he comes from that worldview and why there's value and validity in it. Now, how exactly would I figure that out, matching myself up value-wise? Oh, I'm a doctor that thinks out of the box. I'll give you another example. I don't care about what the standard tests schedule is. Every 3 years for cholesterol, every other year for a pap smear, unless you've been clear for, they've got these standards. I don't care about them. I ignore them. I think me, cholesterol, vegetarian, women in my family live to 90, they're scrappy, they don't eat any meat. I don't believe it. I'm not going to get the cholesterol test. I need somebody who's going to work with that and not be like, the standard says 3 years or whatever it is. I understand I'm a bad patient. My point is, how am I going to get matched up? I'm not going to be able to just name it as freak left Unitarian. How would that help? The guy was also a freak left Unitarian. And he was like, Autumn, follow the schedule of tests. Right? You hear what I'm saying? I think we do have some deep problems here with the deep communities, even if the Catholics, can find their home. And I know that they can't. And lots of examples of that. Let's talk one other thing before we wrap it up for the semester. I'm still grooving on that whole socialist thing. All right, let's talk about the interests. The bias, understandably, in medicine is that it's the health that we're thinking about, the physical body and the health, and mental illness too. I mean, the illness is what we're worried about. But one of the things Veach points out is that there can be a whole lot of other interests that people care very much about that they would use to trade off some of their health interests. And that that without an MD or an RN, knowing that those are trade-offs the person is willing to make, the informed consent procedure couldn't possibly help get them what they would need, given that there are these other interests. So give me an example where you might know, give me a case, a hypothetical or a case you know of, where an interest that you have that's not related to your health, the status, your physical well-being, would be so important that you would take some kind of hit to your health because you wanted to preserve that other interest. And let's not do Jehovah's Witness and blood products, because I'm tired of them. Even though I love them, happy to have you here. But it's so tried and true. It's what else? Give me an interest that somebody would trade off.
My father had pancreatic cancer, and it was very important to him in the summertime to be able to golf and go out to them. So he found an oncologist who would do his treatment cycles in the winter only, recognizing that that was more than suboptimal.
Okay, that's a perfect example. That is a perfect example. Okay, what else?
My father would only go to a cardiologist who smoked.
Okay, or has other habits that you share, because I don't want to be told this, that, or the other thing. So I don't do that, you don't do that, That's who I want to be with. Okay, good. Great. What else? Oh, you're not thinking here. I know you're tired. Come on, end of the semester. 10 minutes before we wrap the whole semester up. Last class, last week, last minute. We can do it.
So from the other perspective, I have a friend that's a physician that will refer out a procedure that she just totally against. She would not touch it.
Absolutely. So even though this might be something that would enhance somebody's health, I won't be part of it.
Right.
Good? All right.
I'm not a good patient either.
Mm-hmm. I can feel that.
Yeah. And I had to change doctors because I had my doctor was so easily manipulated that I could just talk my way out of anything, which is not in my best interest. So I got this Nazi doctor who he is on me all the time, but I'm in better health now.
That's great. And if I had a Nazi doctor, 2 seconds, I totally understand. I do. I understand.
I mean, he's not really a Nazi. there was something wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with being a Nazi. Genocide? Not a problem. All right. Give me some other examples where an interest that you might have would make you potentially compromise something about your health.
As simple as, like, I know I have a physical problem, but I don't want to miss work because I'm going to get in trouble. So I'm not
all right. I don't want to miss work because it's my passion. I don't want to miss it financially. I don't want to miss it because I will lose my job. Okay, there are a lot of times when we could sacrifice a certain kind of interest in that way.
Oh, people actively choose to smoke or eat unhealthy, and they're like, yeah, I know I'm risking my...
Okay, yeah. All right. Every time I go with those donuts, I'm like, they're not good for me, and there's chemicals in them, but yummy, okay. Good, I like that. I know of this case where a woman had a aggressive but stage 1 cancer in one breast, and her odds that she would have cancer in the second breast over the course of her lifetime were 30%. And so the physician was saying, it's obvious, you need a double mastectomy, not a single mastectomy. And she argued, I have a 70% chance that nothing will happen to this breast. And her view was that, and you might say, well, what was the downside? If you're going to lose one breast, you're going to have a disfigurement. But the issue was about how much stuff they could find in other parts of her body to do the reconstruction. So if she had only one breast, there was enough, place to go to get more flesh to do the natural reconstruction rather than implant. But if she had two, she just didn't have enough to go and grab stuff from one place and take it to another. So she decided to just take that risk with monitoring. But that would be, again, where the health outcome would be that you'd minimize your risk, and also that potentially if it's there and they don't find it, you could run the risk of metastasis before they would find it. And yet she actually did select the single mastectomy instead of the double. All right, other examples here? All right, then wrapping the whole thing up, he's got this interesting idea, and I think the appeal of it is that if we could find a good match for our deep values, admitting that our values might change, that's true, so that would always be the problem. But if we could find a good match, maybe it would be some comfort in terms of the way that our dialogue would go about this selection of choices and treatment options that we would want and the information we'd want. But even achieving it at the first pair-up, let alone my changing my values, is actually very difficult. Altogether, then, we think this is very simple. It turns out to actually be very complex, like many of the concepts of bioethics. Okay, folks, we are done. Course wrapped up. Take more classes. Let me know if you have any questions about other classes or... and we need to get rid of leftovers. So we've got 3 sodas and how many pizzas? I will find out, and I will report back. There is only 6 pieces left, no pies. So when you're walking out the door, take pies with you, and I will hopefully see you in January.
I took the 602 last, like in the spring, and I took an incomplete because I didn't finish the final, and so I submitted it like with our midterms. I don't need it like this semester.
Oh, all of those papers will be graded on January 2nd.
Okay, I'm in no rush.
No, but that's what will happen. So okay. I will. I'm collecting them all, and the grades are due January 2nd. They will be done by then. Okay, all right, thank you.
Yep. So I remember in class, whenever you were 16, like the